The new film I, Robot stars Will Smith as a homicide detective seeking a killer among androids.
So why'd you murder him?
I did not murder Dr. Lanning.
Want to explain why you were hiding at the crime scene?
I was frightened.
Robots don't feel fear. They don't feel anything. They don't get hungry. They don't sleep.
I do. I have even had dreams.
Human beings have dreams. Even dogs have dreams, but not you. You are just a machine. An imitation of life. Can a robot write a symphony? Can a robot turn a canvas into a beautiful masterpiece?
Can you?
I think you murdered him because he was teaching you to simulate emotions and things got out of control.
I did not murder him.
I mean, but emotions don't seem like a very useful simulation for a robot.
I did not murder him.
Hell, I don't want my toaster or my vacuum cleaner appearing emotional.
I did not murder him!
I, Robot is loosely based on some 1950s short stories by the legendary science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. When Asimov started writing in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. But through his writing career, he kept looking ahead, projecting what life might be like in the future. Asimov died in 1992, leaving us with over 350 books of science fiction and science fact. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1987 and told her about the first story he got published.
Marooned off Vesta. And I sold it on October 21st, 1938, and it appeared in the stands in the March 1939 issue of Amazing Stories, which hit the stands on January 9th, 1939, 1 week after my 19th birthday.
So what was that first story about?
It was a ship that had gone through the asteroid belt and was hit by an asteroid, and there was just a piece of it left with three men on board, and they had to get themselves down to the asteroid Vesta, which was nearby. And I made it sound as exciting as I could possibly manage. And they bought it. They paid me $64 for it.
Now, what did you base those early stories on? On actual science knowledge that you had or on other science fiction stories that you read?
Mostly on other science fiction stories. Although they got me interested in science, and I gradually learned science as a result. But science fiction was an even earlier influence.
Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was in fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language, and I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that we used in science fiction. They were made of metal and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines, and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible, because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared, and the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very, very well, I'm glad to say, because they're hard to do.
Had you lost your interest in science fiction during that hiatus?
No, not at all. But I had thought that the field had gotten beyond me. You know, it's a rapidly developing field, and the science fiction that's written today isn't at all like the science fiction I wrote in my time. And I felt that I was just a quaint hangover from a previous generation, and that it would show. And I didn't make any effort to write in the 80s fashion, let us say. They wanted another Foundation book. I wrote it exactly as I wrote my Foundation books in the 1940s. And it seemed to go well. So I continued writing in my way, regardless of any changes that had taken place. And there seemed to be enough people who are willing to read my stuff, written in its way, for it to be reasonably successful. So I'm happy.
I think it's fair to say that you've been pretty obsessed with the brain over the years. You've written a lot of science books and science essays about the brain, and I think, is it fair to say that that's the organ of the body that interests you most?
Well, in a way, yes. In the first place, that's the way I make my living. I mean, I use my brain such as it is. And in the second place, it is at once the most hopeful and the most dangerous part of the human body. Most hopeful because solutions to problems arise from the human brain. And the most dangerous because the problems themselves also arise from the human brain. It's the thoughts, the ideas, the genius that solve the problems, but it's our tendency towards hatreds and fears and suspicions that create the problems. And we don't know how the brain works. So that naturally makes it all the more interesting.
You know, your book, Fantastic Voyage, reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you were afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. It's, when I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
Isaac Asimov speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1987. He died in 1992.